Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. And before we start, and before I introduce Grant, I'll introduce myself. I'm Brooke Warner, and I'm the publisher of She Writes Press, and we thank you for, thank you for coming out to see us and this conversation that Grant and I are going to have today. One thing is that I've just been told that when it comes to the Q&A section, you will actually have to physically get up and come to the front. You're not allowed to touch the mic. So I want you all to be psychologically prepared for that, so that
you'll be kicked out if you touch the mic.
Yeah, so that Grant and I aren't sitting here going, anyone come to the front, please. So yes, please come to the front and ask questions. So now let me introduce Grant. Grant is the executive director of National Novel Writing Month, which I think you all know, the co-founder of 100 Word Story. His stories have appeared in dozens of literary journals, including the Gettysburg Review, the Southwest Review, and Tin House. His essays on creativity have been published in the New York Times, Poets and Writers, Writer's Digest, and The Writer. It's really long. I'm going to embarrass Grant. He's like, I think it's really long. You should cut some, but I didn't want to cut any of it. We're talking a lot today about his new book, Pep Talks for Writers, which will be for sale afterward. Here we go. It's awesome. And he has also published a collection of 100-word stories. Fissures. And his stories have been included in Best Small Fictions 2016 and the upcoming anthology New Micro Exceptionally Short Stories. How short are those?
Under 300 words.
Oh, under 300.
Mine are 100, though.
And Grant also got his MA in creative writing at SF State, so local boy here. The world needs your novel. That's the tagline of National Novel Writing Month, and which is the nonprofit literary phenomenon run by Grant. And NaNoWriMo now boasts approximately 400,000 participants who pledge to write a full novel in a month. They each write their own book made up of at least 50,000 words every November. How many here are NaNoWriMo alum? Handful?
All right.
Okay, awesome. Maybe everyone.
All of you will be after this November.
Yes, get yourself also psychologically prepared for that. Some highly successful works have come out of the initiative, including Sarah Grin's Water for Elephants and Rainbow Rowell's Fangirl. So that's pretty awesome. So join me in welcoming Grant. Thank you.
Thanks, Brooke. That's great. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
All right, so I loved Pep Talk for Writers, Pep Talks for Writers, because there are 52. I just thought it's such a fun book. The tone is super inspiring. I noted particularly that you had so many personal anecdotes and a lot of truly insightful offerings. And I wanted to hear about this process for you, how much of it was written for you, from your own, you know, from what you needed to hear for yourself, and how much of it was written for the people that you work with every day at NaNoWriMo?
Yeah, both. I think it's a 50-50 split. Although, sometimes when I talk to people, I say, I actually need to take some of my own advice. You know, right. It's easy to dispense advice. Sometimes it's harder to take it. But, you know, when I started out as a writer, I just knew so little about what it meant to be a writer. You know, I mean, I was 20 years old. I was deciding between being a major in econ or English, and I had to declare at the end of my sophomore year. And very fortunately, I went on a semester abroad in France, and I spent the whole time just sitting in cafes and reading novels. You know, so I said, this is like the way I want to live life, you know? And I kind of just assumed that maybe it would take me 2 or 3 years to write this amazing novel that would, you know, be optioned by Hollywood, and I'd be able to sit in those cafes and read books the rest of my life. That didn't happen, unfortunately. So it's just, I feel like the journey of being a writer, you can't predict it. You go to so many weird places. You change. I mean, now that I've been doing it for 30 years, there's just so many different unexpected challenges, and along that, you know, when I started, it was pre-internet, so I was just super hungry for writing advice. And back then, there were literally only about 5 to 7 how to write books. You know, right. Like if you went into any bookstore, there were very few. So getting writing wisdom was really difficult. And so there are hundreds, if not thousands, of them now. It's a very crowded market. But I think every writer's path is different. And so this book was one part me just reflecting on what I would have liked to know when I was 20 years old. But there's a big part. I deal with writers every day. And the NaNoWriMo community is this amazing community of writers, and so I get to be in touch with those people, no matter where they are. We have absolute beginning writers, people like 12-year-old kids who write a novel, up to Marissa Meyer, who's a best-selling author, and she does NaNoWriMo every year, So I get to talk to so many people at different stages of their writing lives, and so this, a lot of people think it's just for beginning writers. I think not, really. I think any writer can benefit from this book. I've written it for everybody.
I absolutely agree with that. I was flipping the pages and thinking I was just going to dive in a little bit and take a look. I'm like, I know all this stuff. I work with writers too. And then, but I loved the tone so much. And I did feel like there was stuff in there that felt like it must have been in part you speaking to yourself a little bit. So, there's one chapter called Treating Imposter Syndrome, and you write, "Humility is a good thing, one of my favorite traits in people." I also think of you as being really humble. We've worked together a bit. I've watched you work crowds at conferences, and I'm always struck by how gracious you are. So I am curious if this is a trait that serves you and or a trait that you value, and if you could just say a word about whether you're even aware of your humility.
I don't know how aware of it I am, but I have mixed feelings about humility, actually. I think... generally, I think we do like people who are humble versus arrogant, for example. But I think like cultivating writing makes you humble, for one. It's so challenging. You have this vision of a book or story in your head, and getting it out of your head onto the page is just like a really humbling, challenging experience. And so I think writers need to be humble, because when you're humble, you're putting yourself in service to the story and in service to yourself, really. I think when people are humble, they're more open to the world. They're more likely to listen to other people and to try to see the world through their eyes. And so these are traits that I think make a good writer. On the other hand, I think humility can veer towards meekness sometimes, and I've certainly struggled with that. And when I think about those moments in my life when I've erred on the side of meekness, there's nothing worse than that. And as a writer, I think the best writing comes when you're really brave on the page, when you're writing your story and doing it your way. And when you get to the point, if you want to publish that story too, I feel like so many writers are held back by their meekness or their being overly humble somehow, so it can turn into a weakness. So I think it's just something to balance. I think we all need to do that. I don't think the meek will inherit the earth. I don't think the meek will inherit their books, really. I think writing a book is an amazing act of bravery and courage. And so, but I think on the other hand, though, being humble, I think allows you to really be in service of that story in a very pure way.
Well, it's tough today, too, with social media, and we've talked about this a little before, that there's this strong expectation on writers to be out there and posting photos of yourself and talking about yourself. So, in essence, you kind of have to rise to that a bit. So I appreciate what you're saying about it being a balance. And, do you think you under-post?
This is the fascinating question for the modern writer, is how much to post on social media. And because we're generally pretty humble creatures, I think, by nature, and relatively introverted. And so this idea that we have to build these, social media platforms in order to get both... published, actually, editors look at how many followers you have and how active you are and what you say and how is it responded to. It's very unfortunate, because writers, we all just want to sit in our rooms and write, but unfortunately the world of being at least a published writer requires you to do this. I don't like it, but I have to do it,
Yes, I hear that quite a lot from my own authors. So writing 52 ideas is no easy task. So I'm just curious, what was your process and how did you decide on the structure? And maybe you could talk a little bit about how your role at as executive director at NaNoWriMo inform that process?
Yeah. You know, when I first started at NaNoWriMo, one of the things I noticed afterwards, people would just get so galvanized by this experience of writing a novel in a month, and they would discover themselves as writers and creators, and they wanted to keep going naturally and write year-round, but it's tough to write year-round. So I kept hearing these stories about people, how they would, you know, it's like New Year's resolutions. Like, most New Year's resolutions actually only last about a month. And so we've structured National Novel Writing Month, the organization, to support people with writing year-round, and this book is kind of spawned by that. That's why, no surprise, there are 52 essays, you know, one for each week, essentially, although they're not really chronologically ordered. So yeah, I thought one way to help people write year-round is to help people nourish a creative mindset, you know, that so that they can be creative in some way, even a small way, every day. Because I feel like big things are built in small increments, essentially. So the main thing is just to keep going and keep doing it. You don't have to do it every day, but make it a priority in your life. And I think that's one really tough thing about becoming an adult, is that writing, I always say writing or your creativity falls lower and lower on your to-do list until it's basically not there, you know? And so I think that that's one of the benefits of NaNoWriMo, is it opens up the doors and tells you can do it in just 1 month, you know? Try to write 50,000 words in 1 month, and that means making creativity a true priority. So maybe don't do the dishes that month, you know? Maybe ask your friends and family to help out. You know what I mean? Like creativity is not a neat thing. Sometimes you have to give up things in order to make it happen. But I think one of it's sad, I guess, that a lot of people, I'll hear from people, I'm not a creative type, you know, and I think that this book is really trying to address that, to help everybody see themselves as a creative type and help everyone see themselves as real writers.
It's funny that you say that, because I teach memoir, and a lot of people who come to memoir are later in life writers, and so I wonder if that's kind of a thing, like it's one of the things about becoming an adult that you it drops to the bottom of your priority list, but then I think as you age, you know, whether it's retirement or you hit a certain point in your life where you're like, I'm not doing that anymore, and then so it seems that to me that might open up to older writers in some way.
I think so. I think there's this great quote from Picasso that I reference a lot, but it's like how every child is born a creator, but the challenge is how to remain a creator as an adult. He says it more eloquently than that. But I think we get swarmed by all the shoulds in our life, and it's just unfortunate that we allow those shoulds to kind of smother our creative sparks.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great transition, because I noticed all of those references you have. Just to name a few: Picasso, Homer, Thomas Edison, Ray Bradbury, Maya Angelou, people who are still alive, Junot Diaz, and others. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost on every entry. And I was wondering why you wanted to include historical and modern writer figures and use anecdotes from those people. And had they inspired you, or did you just feel that that was good storytelling technique?
Kind of all of the above, but I will say, like, when I was that young writer, when I was 20 years old and just searching for writing wisdom, I was constantly writing down quotes on little note cards. So I think I come from a family of collectors. I always say that what I'd really like to do in life is be a rag picker and just collect a lot of weird objects, and I guess part of those weird objects are quotes. But one thing, I mean, so those quotes are there both for inspiration, validation, and support of, like, whatever I'm talking about. But, you know, I think it's also, I was thinking about this morning, how there's all this great research on creativity these days, because neuroscience has come so far, and they can put your, you know, see what's happening in your brain while you're doing different things. And every time I read one of these studies, I think they're really fascinating, because what they really do is they're not really telling us, I mean, they're telling us how our brains are creative, but they're really just validating what past artists already know. And the thing is, if you engage in creativity, whether it's dance or art or writing, you will intuitively know what the best process is. You know, you don't need neuroscience to validate it. And so I think, like, a lot of these quotes just kind of speak to that, is like, it's a shared experience. And everyone's different, but there are a lot of shared experiences as creators. And I just want to mention one.
Yeah.
So, because it's my single favorite one, I think if you guys can leave here with one thing to do, this is it. And so it comes from Toni Morrison. She was a single working mom in New York City before she was a published author, and the way she got her first novel written and published was after she put her kids to bed at night. She had about 15 minutes before she had to go to bed. So the lowest moment of her day, she was exhausted. She wasn't feeling especially creative or inspired, but she sat down and wrote for 15 minutes a day. And so that's how she wrote her first novel. And so I hear from people a lot, like, I don't have time to write. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to do NaNoWriMo. Whatever it is, I'm convinced that everyone has time. And you can open up that 15 minutes a day. And here, I'm going to do some math for you, because writers usually don't. NaNoWriMo has helped me do the math of writing. Because to do NaNoWriMo, you have to write 1,700 words a day. So let's say you write for 15 minutes. Let's say you write 250 words in that 15-minute span every day. So that's 7,500 words a month, and that's 90,000 words a year, and that's a big novel. So there you go. You can all leave now. That came from Toni Morrison.
I like that, too, because it's inspiration for writing, and I am hearing you say that all science does is validate what we already know. So thanks for that.
Yeah. And math. We need to turn to math.
Yes, science and math. Okay. Yeah. So... this session, I thought this was funny because Grant and I didn't write this part, that this session was billed as being able to turn inspiration into tangible product. And I
wow.
And I said to Grant, that's a pretty tall order. So,
yeah, what is a tangible product?
So, but you are really inspiring, and I do want to talk about that for a second. It's kind of funny because it's kind of like the humility question. Do you feel inspiring? You know, do you set out to be inspiring, or is that part of your job at NaNoWriMo? And do you think that you held some of those qualities before you got that position, or has it really just been NaNoWriMo that has kind of been like, you know, you gotta inspire the people?
Mm-hmm. I'm really a very gloomy, dark, melancholic person. And then one night at midnight, I was watching the Home Shopping Network, and I signed up for an inspiration course, and I got a certificate in inspiration for $59, and I'll give out the cards for that, because I'm now getting a revenue share from this company. I have no idea. One of the great lessons of being involved in NaNoWriMo, because I am kind of gloomy a lot of the time, to tell you the truth. I love, when I write, I listen to really kind of gloomy, melancholic music, and my son will always walk in and just bewilderment. Why would you do that to yourself? I don't know. But one of the joys of NaNoWriMo, you know, it's a organization and a movement kind of founded on optimism and on this kind of can-do spirit. And I've been involved in a lot of different writing communities, you know, everything from my MFA to writing groups of different sorts. And I find a lot of writing communities actually very uninspiring. And it's because they're based on kind of getting published. And so you're receiving critiques and feedback, and you're kind of competing against each other. You know, groups have a tendency to form their own hierarchies. Not that that's bad. There's a lot of great workshops and programs and writing groups, and I recommend everybody do that. I love doing it. But the one thing about NaNoWriMo that I find fascinating is it's based on empowerment, and it's based on helping motivate people to reach their creative potential and realize their creative dreams. It's not about necessarily helping people get published, although a lot of people do publish their work after participating in NaNoWriMo. So I guess I feel like I've just fed off of that community energy. Like, I'm always really touched by it. If you go on Twitter during the month of November and look at the hashtag NaNoWriMo, what you'll mainly see is people encouraging other people to keep going and to reach that 50,000 word count, you know? And they'll be doing it, it's not like they're doing it with their friends, they'll be doing it to strangers. You know, somebody will post, I missed 3 days of writing, and then you'll see 10 people or right. 20 people just jump in there. And so I've been very inspired by just the community itself, and it's a blessed to just feed off of that energy.
It is really cool at NaNoWriMo, and I will say for people, because only a couple of you raised your hands, if you're writing other genres, now other genres have completely co-opted NaNoWriMo. It's not only for novel writing, and so if you're doing a memoir, any kind of writing, you can participate in NaNoWriMo in November, so just a note about that.
We've had people write their dissertations during NaNoWriMo, seriously? I'm sure we've had all kinds of books. We really want people to write, so... About 98% of the people who sign up write novels, but you can write anything. And I think it's a really good writing framework. Just this, we call the goal and the deadline is a creative midwife. And it really is. It holds you accountable. No matter if you set a goal of 20,000 or 25,000 or 50,000 words. You know, the main thing is to have that goal and a deadline and to hold yourself accountable every day.
I'm excited. I'm going to do it this year.
Yeah.
You must have told me this at some point. I don't remember the context about that you, in the evenings, walk around your neighborhood walking your dog.
It's a strange figure and, walking around.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, you tell me that you, like, put wine in your coffee mug. Is that just my...
Are there any police officers here? my neighbors have this joke. What's in Grant's mug?
All right, maybe I just imagined that it was wine.
It is. At least in the evening.
It is. Well, I am curious just about that process, because it seemed to me like a very daydreamy kind of activity. I actually do love this idea of walking around my own neighborhood with wine. I'm going to start doing it immediately.
I'm like the only one doing it in North Berkeley. I'm like, why aren't these people with their dogs? It just seems very civilized and
creative. It is very civilized, absolutely. It's very French or something. It must have been from all that time.
So, or Iowan.
what do you get from it? I mean, talk about daydreaming, and do you think about writing, or do you just kind of clear your head at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's interesting about being a writer, and I definitely get in this trap, is that because it's so hard to kind of wake up and write every day, and there's always this, you know, I was talking to a writer the other day, and we were joking about how you're never done. You know, like you never, even when you like finish a novel and send it off and it's published, you're not done. You're still, you move on, you get like a week or something, and then you move on to another project. And so I think we all want like more time at our laptops. And I think I can undervalue the benefits of other types of creative time. And so I one part of me resents my dog because I didn't want, I'm a dog person. I've had dogs, but when my kids got to the age that they really wanted a dog, I did the math. I was like, I'm going to be the one to walk this dog. And that could be as much as an hour a day, which is like 365 hours a year, or let's say 300 hours. That's like, that's 150,000 words I'm giving up a year for this dog.
Math guy.
Yeah. But, the walks are super beneficial because, one, I think walking is good for creativity no matter what. And I think like as long as we're opening up windows of time to daydream, and sometimes I will make sure that I'm thinking about my writing in some ways and just let things percolate in strange, random ways. And I think that's really good as long as you don't do too much of it, because you do have to return to your laptop. So if anyone wants to join me for a dog walk, I'm usually in North Berkeley around 5 o'clock, and you can spot me with the strange mug.
Bring your own mug.
Yeah, bring your own mug. Cordonesis Park.
So you have a very writerly last name. Well, actually the whole name, Grant Faulkner. It sounds very sophisticated to me. But, you know, of course I think of William Faulkner, and he's such an American legacy. And I was just one of the most famous writers of all times, probably. And I am curious, you know, if obviously it must come up. And does that boost your confidence?
No. Nothing like that. It's actually this strange burden. I want to gather a collection of stories someday of people who hold a name of somebody famous. You know, like somewhere out there, somebody has been named Beyonce, and Madonna, and what? Jabba. Yeah, yeah. And the funny thing is, like, you're just assigned this name as a kid. You never really think it's anybody else's name. Like, I never really think about William Faulkner. He's kind of foisted upon me. I actually did end up doing my dissertation when I was getting my MFA on him, so which was great. And he is a NaNoWriMo type of writer. In his most prolific periods, he was writing about 3,000 words a day. He wrote as much as 10,000 words a day, which is just crazy. Wow. If you've ever done that. But yeah, when I was an English major, half the time the professors would be like, ha ha ha, somebody hacked into the class roster here, you know? So it's been kind of a burden, actually, and I've been asked that thousands of times, and I actually,
I think it's time to reframe it and embrace it.
And William Faulkner, actually, he added the U to his name. He was born F-A-L-K-N-E-R. He added the U because his grandfather was a writer, and he wanted to differentiate himself, so, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So a little history about Mr. Faulkner there.
Yeah.
Prior to Pep Talks for Writers, you've written mainly fiction. I know you were a journalist for a while, so you could talk about that as well. But what was it like to write a more prescriptive book, particularly a book of inspiration? And what was different about this process than writing fiction?
Yeah. How many people are nonfiction writers in the room here? Okay, good. Writing nonfiction is way easier.
Unless you're writing memoir, maybe.
Yeah, memoir.
You've got to stick up for the memoirist.
Yeah, I will. Well, I consider memoir fiction. I don't really put it in the nonfiction category. It's a story, you know. I did find it easier. And I think, well, maybe it was just because it was an essay form, too, not like a whole book. But I found, like, you know, like if you're writing on the topic of vulnerability, or I don't know, any topic. It's so you have it's so purposeful, you know? It's so, you're driven about this one topic, and you explore it, and you think about it, and you do some research, and whatever. And I just found, like, I don't know how long each of these essays are. They're pretty short, probably 750 words or 1,000 words. Yeah, they're just so pointed. So I found it really a nice pace to kind of wake up and work on an essay, say, for like a week, and then move on to the next one. So it had a really nice rhythm, a good sense of completion, and also just like constantly learning more about these topics, where you can do that with a novel, but a novel is like so open-ended, you know? Mm-hmm. It can be anything, you know? And while you're writing it, I mean, at least my creative process, especially in that rough draft stage, is I view that as a draft of experimentation and exploration. Like, I'm always hunting for the story. And so while some of these ideas might be in a novel, you're conveying them in such a different way. You know, you're conveying them through scenes, you're illustrating them, you're trying to be subtle and weave it into dialogue and themes. It's just you have all of these, like, parts. And they're not exactly, they don't exactly fit together, you know, I guess.
Yeah, it makes sense. I also think, I mean, if you know your topic or your subject matter and you're coming as an expert, it does seem like that would be infinitely easier. I find that people struggle so much with memoir and fiction for reasons of confidence sometimes, you know, and exposure and, like you're saying, looking for the storyline. There's maybe a lot more nuance to that process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed, like, the people, when I think about myself too, like, it is such a crazy thing to start a novel, to like get this idea today and go home and maybe spend the next 5 to 10 years like writing it, you know, like,
right.
Because you have to be really stubborn and dogged and relentless, and sometimes you only know if it's good in the writing, you know, like there are millions of novel ideas out there. They're all good, really. It's all in the execution. And so it's a really big challenge to know. And again, you can go down so many rabbit holes, and you kind of have to discover the story. Karen Russell has this great quote, and it jives with everything I've talked with other writers about. She says that 90% of her rough draft is thrown out by the eventual finished product. Mm-hmm. And so that's a great lesson, and don't get overly attached to the words or scenes in your rough draft, because I think to view it more as an experiment or exploratory process helps you be less attached to them. And it's just going to be, you know, you're going to refine things and rewrite things, and your editor will demand things too. So yeah, a novel changes so much.
I like that you say they're all good. It's sort of making me question your taste, because we were driving the other day and I told Grant about this novel idea I'd heard at a conference pitched to me that was like from the point of view of this woman's 5 dead dogs telling the story of her life. And Grant's like, I love that. That sounds amazing.
I love that. I'm going to steal like, that idea.
No. I'm going to read that one.
No, it's all in the execution.
It is all in the execution. Yeah. Now I think I've got it. Yeah. So tell us about 100 Word Story. This is a whole other arena of your life outside of NaNoWriMo. And are your submissions open to the public?
Yes.
How often do you publish? And what about 100 Word Stories and brevity in general interests you?
Yeah, I was working on one of these, I call it my doomed novel. I ended up spending, I mean, I didn't spend like every day over the course of 8 or 10 years, but I spent a lot of time. That was my major work that I was doing. And in the midst of this, a friend of mine's father, Paul Strome, he had posted some stories, these little 100-word stories that he'd written 100 of them as his memoir. And I thought it was a beautiful way to think about memoir, because I think sometimes we think we have to have this big dramatic life experience, like going to war or overcoming addiction or something. But they allowed him to capture all these tiny little moments in his life that were really meaningful or entertaining. And so I started doing them with a friend, except that I wrote fiction instead of memoir. And they were so, it was so challenging to tell a story in 100 words. And so when I started writing these, I could only get them down to 150 words. And I told Paul, I was like, hey, I wrote a really short story. It's 150 words. And he kept telling me, no, you have to get them down to 100. That's where you'll find the main creative benefits, is to honor that constraint. Mm-hmm. He compared it to taking a photo with a fixed lens, like where you can't zoom in or out. Mm-hmm. And so it built in this discipline of, for me, the wonderful benefit is, one, I think a lot of unknown creative benefits come from constraints, whether it's the constraint of writing a novel in a month or the constraint of writing a 100-word story or a haiku or a sonnet. It forces you to think about things in a different way. And so for me to tell a story in 100 words, I had to figure out how to make the story work with what's not included in it. So Hemingway has this famous iceberg metaphor for writing short stories or for writing stories in general. And he says, you know, that an iceberg, about 80 or 90% of it is beneath the water. And so it's left out. You don't see it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I think it's a really good metaphor to think about writing fiction, at least. And especially these little tiny 100-word stories, because you're really trying to, they're all about suggestiveness, like suggesting and hinting at the story and letting the reader fill in the gaps. So you have to decide what can be left out. And it's a really fascinating process. It also makes you pay attention to every word and every sentence. They have to be doing a lot of work to further the story. So anyway, I found it very addictive. And I basically ditched the novel. I did finish it. But so I started writing these, and I was writing them with a friend, and then I was just thinking about, like, this was, you know, flash fiction has really emerged. It's really a lot of, especially young writers, I think, have gravitated towards it, and I think it's because it's very internet friendly. And so this was 7 years ago, almost to the day, and I just thought that 100 words was the perfect amount of text to read on the internet. And you can see it's about a paragraph. Like, here's my book, and if people can see that, you know, it's not much space. And we just, actually, I'm just going to do a little promotion. We just published our first collection. This is the best 100-word stories that we've published for the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. So this just came out with a small press called Outpost 19 in San Francisco. So anyway, I guess the lesson for me is it helped me, for my longer works, think about suspense and think about what could be left out. Because novels are so much about that connective tissue and making sure that everything's kind of connected and building and that the reader can understand this whole backstory and setting and everything. But sometimes it's like good to question what needs to be there. And it's actually really informed my, I think my novels now are much more kind of elliptical and fragmentary, and it's just a different reading experience and writing experience. And I don't think I answered all your questions.
Well, the question I wanted for the audience was where they can submit and how often you publish, in case people wanted to try to do it and submit.
Yeah, so go to 100wordstory.org. It's a website, so we're online only except for this collection. And we accept submissions throughout the year. Unfortunately, we have to charge the lowest price that Submittable will allow us to charge. I think it's $3, and that's only because we receive so many submissions we can't pay for their extra whatever. I hate to charge authors, but it's a small fee. And we also, though, have a monthly photo prompt. So every month we put up a new photo. And so everybody can write online and contribute. So that's open. And then we choose one story every month to publish formally. And we have this great photo editor who chooses a photo and matches it up with every story. So it's photos and stories. And that's because I think photos are a snapshot, obviously. And these little stories are like a snapshot, too.
How long does it take to read a 100-word story?
We could time it right now.
20 seconds?
So there are two different answers. So technically, you could read a 100-word story. Yeah, I'm probably like 30 seconds or so. Grace Paley, who wrote a lot of really short stories, she said that they should be, like, they demand reading again and again and again, kind of like a poem.
Right.
And I think that that's true. Yeah.
That's cool. I love it. Well, I love a lot of the pep talks in this book. This is kind of a long question because I'm going to read a little bit from one of your entries. But this one that gave me goosebumps in particular was something that I think we all struggle with, which is confidence. We mentioned it before. But also the inner critic, writing to please others. And so you have an entry called Know Thyself, where you write, "Writing to please quickly became boring to me." And you write about not paying attention to what other people think and to answer yourself every time. I think I love this book because it's kind of similar to a message that I have around green lighting authors, and so much of what she writes is founded on. Tell me a bit about this. I mean, you say this notion I think we both believe in, that the gatekeepers not be the ultimate authority. And how does Know Thyself inform your process and your job at NaNoWriMo? And is, you know, like everything, how much is that an ongoing practice?
Great. I do want to plug Brooke's book here. It's called Greenlight Your Book. And part of the reason we're doing this is that we do share similar messages. You know, I mean, I'm more focused on the greenlight your creativity, but greenlighting your book, it's like a whole different stage. So I really recommend it. I think about the I remember when I first encountered that Greek maxim, know thyself, and it sounds so simple, right? I mean, it seems like it should be easy for us to know ourselves, but I think it's really challenging. And part of that is because there are just so many voices in the world that are crowding our minds, no matter what, and we have to learn how to navigate that kind of nettlesome, thorny path. Mm-hmm. And I think about when I first became a writer, I was amazed that my parents who grew up in the Depression, and they were very practical-minded people, they never questioned of what I was doing. And I thought that was this magnificent gift, really, because I can't imagine what it would be like to start with like feeling displeasure or, you know, not that approbation. But I mention this because that one of their friends was very dubious, very questioning of my endeavor. And I remember going out to dinner. This is like the thing about being a writer, is that a lot of non-writers give you advice. Like, I give no advice to doctors or engineers or accountants, you know? But people love giving writers really heavy-handed or judgmental advice for some reason. And anyway, this guy, he was looking at me and very worried about my financial future. which was probably wise, but he told me, he's like, you know what I would do if I were you? I would go to the New York Times, I would see what the top 5 bestsellers are, and I would study them, and I would do every single thing that they're doing. You know, just do what they're doing, and then you will have a bestseller, you know. I don't know. I mean, fortunately, I was very dismissive of that, fortunately, because, I mean, for me, the whole endeavor of being a writer is to tell your story, you know, and I was, I wrote an article last fall with 100 reasons why I write, you know, and there are 100 or more reasons, and I view that they're very sacred, you know, like, this is like, it's a mission, I'm not doing it for the money. If I wanted to create, like, he was telling me to create a product, and if I wanted to create a product, I would go into different businesses, you know, and no one knows how to, I mean, no one has the prescription for a bestseller. If they did, the world would be a different place. Editors would be handing writers templates and say, just do this. And that doesn't, you know, it's unpredictable. Brooke knows more about this than I do because she's on the publishing side. So, you know, I've just tried never to write for those commercial purposes. I understand when people do, but I also think the value of writing is in that premise of know thyself. And I recently was listening to this podcast. I listened to podcasts at like 2 a.m., so I might get this story wrong, but it was Brené Brown talking to Krista Tippett on being. And she was talking about our human need, like belonging, like our need to belong because we're group-oriented species. And so, you know, there's different layers of belonging, right? Like at the far edges, there are people who don't belong and they feel alienated. Then there's like people who are trying to fit in some ways. So you're wearing a veils or clothing that is not you. You're creating a persona. Or you belong to a group and you have genuine belonging to it. But then there's a deeper level of belonging when you belong to something beyond and greater than the group structure. And that's when you are honoring a truth and really doing so. Because if you have that deep kind of belonging, you might say things that the group doesn't like. Like you're saying something that no one will say. And I think that's the author's duty, is to say what other people aren't brave enough or don't have the capacity to say. And that's where I think know thyself comes in. And I actually have a theory that, you know, there part of the writing world, it's all about like, how do you create suspense? How do you write a great plot? How do you write great dialogue? All those craft things are really valuable as a writer, but I think that the books that speak to us the most are the books where the author made himself or herself vulnerable and really hit a truth that is just like deep and hasn't been spoken.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's interesting what you say, because, you know, one of the most vexing things about publishing, I think, in general, is that there's this perception that, you know, there are just these big books out there. And one of the reasons I left traditional publishing, actually, was because the publisher would always say, go find a big book. And that was it. You know, when, what is the big book? You know, what the hell does that mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that's just this, you know, what people love about books is kind of not quantifiable sometimes.
Yeah.
So
yeah, very mysterious.
So you're married to a writer author, and I think, you know, that's always interesting. Other people might be as well. What's that like for both of you in terms of your process and you know, the publishing pursuits and the creative process as well?
Well, at dinner, a lot of times we say one of us should have married somebody who made money. That's kind of where we went wrong. But we both did it. We both made the same mistake. You know, it's gone a lot of different directions. I think at its best, you know, again, like being a writer, writing every day, all those crazy challenges one faces, I mean, she understands all of that, and I do too. And at our best, we support each other no matter, we never question each other's creative endeavors. Mm-hmm. Like she didn't look at my 100-word story project and say, how are you going to make money off of that? Because that was never the intent, really. And so, you know, it's nice to have somebody who both understands the writing process and the publishing process and just, you know, all the crazy things one encounters. You know, it's also hard because we both want more writing time, and time is a scarce resource in our family, especially with kids. But again, I think like when we, especially when our kids were younger, we had shifts. I always joke that no one saw our entire family in one place at one time because usually one of us was writing. So like I would have Saturday morning with the kids, and then I'd have Saturday afternoon to write. I think unlike a lot of, I mean, I don't know, I guess every writing couple I know is very different. We don't read each other's stuff very often. You know, I know certain, I think it was Michael Chabon and Ayel at Waldman, I think they read it right when it comes off the printer, essentially. They're constantly giving it to each other feedback, and that's wonderful. We just, you know, I think it's not like we don't, we would read each other's stuff if there was a request for help, but I also find that that can be a strange ingredient in a relationship, you know, because getting feedback is, whatever, fraught with drama, perhaps. You know, I don't know.
You didn't love it?
Yeah. You're supposed to love it. Yeah.
Well, and this is, you know, maybe another kind of identity belonging question about being a West Coast writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely have mixed feelings. I think you do as well, being in this industry, and or being a writer, and you're with NaNoWriMo, so it's another organization that's West Coast based, and yet so much of publishing is so New York centric. Mm-hmm. So what are your feelings about doing this endeavor on the West Coast?
Yeah, they are complicated feelings, especially as I get older. I feel like since I grew up in this small town in Iowa, I feel like I've always been on the outside looking in. And there's probably never any way in my life that I'll feel like I'm actually on the inside. And so I feel that way about New York writers as well. I remember the last time I was in New York, I was walking around. I was like, this is such a wonderful city, and every writer in the world is here, and every publishing contact in the world is here. Why didn't I move here when I was in my 20s and could have, you know, been poor and scrappy, and I don't know, and made it all happen? I think in some ways, though, creatively, New York would have been really overwhelming. And I always hear how cutthroat and competitive it is, and I think that that could have hindered my creative process. It might have, like, shut me down and inhibited me in a lot of ways. When I moved to San Francisco was my big city. It was plenty big for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting now here, both on, you know, on the nonprofit, the writing side, the publishing side. I mean, somebody told me that San Francisco is the second biggest publishing center in the United States after New York City, but I don't really think of it that way because I think it's kind of cozy. We went to this party last night, the Bay Area Book Fest Gala, and basically everybody in the Bay Area was there, you know, in one room. But I think there is, and I also think like there is something about the San Francisco and that whole spirit of rogues, you know, like rogues and misfits have come out here for generations, maybe not now because it's too high priced, but there is this amazing and wonderful tradition. And if you look at the people who've ended up here and who've written, they're people who took amazing creative risks with their lives and their words, you know. And so I think I think we have a natural sort of rebellious gatecrashing spirit, and I like to think, you know, I like to be around that. And I think NaNoWriMo is that, you know. NaNoWriMo's message is that everyone has a story to tell and that your story matters. So you don't have to be in Brooklyn. You don't have to take MFA classes. You just need to write your story your way, you know. So
I love that. I think you are a bit of a rogue. And definitely NaNoWriMo is. This might be my last question, so everybody get ready to come up. It's about NaNoWriMo, and it's about NaNoWriMo's popularity, because you'll tell me how many years you've been the executive director of NaNoWriMo, mm-hmm. and I just feel like it's so captured the spirit, and people everywhere love it, and I just think it seems like your numbers are rising all the time. I mean, you spoke a little bit about it, and that it's this, you know, community that is so inspiring to people, but, you know, what is that special thing about it that, you know, keeps people coming back and that is growing the platform?
You know, it's a really good question. I think it's really about the passions of the people in the community who spread the word, and it is about that encouraging spirit. You know, like we are not only online based, we have 1,000 volunteers around the world who host writing gatherings. We call them write-ins, all designed to motivate people to write. And also, those volunteers, it's all about welcoming in everybody and being inclusive, you know, and crashing these gates, basically, right. Like breaking down the gates and allowing people to be, you know, one of the things that really I get frustrated with and disturbed, and one reason I wrote the book, is that so many people will tell me they're not a creative type. So you're a creative type by virtue of being human, you know. Everyone is a writer because you write. Like a lot of people get hung up on, I'm not a real writer because I'm not published, but you're a real writer if you sit down and write. So I think it is that, in the end, that message of encouragement and motivation and also fun, you know. Like a lot of writing organizations or writing movements kind of forget the joy. You know, that we you know, it can be a very anguishing experience. Right. I always call NaNoWriMo like a rollicking boot camp. It's one part party, but it is one part boot camp because it takes a lot to write 50,000 words in a month. It takes a lot to write 10,000 words in a month. But I think it is that it allows people to make creativity and writing a priority for a month, and it's such a meaningful experience. And it's free. There's nothing to risk. We do take donations, by the way. So I think it's that spirit, that of welcome, that you are a creator, just do it.
I can see that for sure. Yeah. And before we move to Q&A, I do want to plug on our mutual behalf that we're starting a podcast together called Right Minded. And it made me think of, well, I'm thinking about it all the time because we're constantly talking about it. But one of our first guests is going to be Mark Nepo, who is a poet and a writer. And he has just written a book about writing. And he was talking about, he will be talking about writing as a birthright and the value of self-expression just as a human being and how important that is to how we see the world and how we process our experience. And so it just reminds me of what you're talking about right now. And I think it's going to be a perfect, perfect inroad, you know, early podcast. Yeah.
To be a creator and not just a consumer is a big leap. And I think sometimes we trivialize stories and creativity. Like our stories not only reflect who we are and who the world is, but our stories like shape what the world is.
Right.
I like thinking about this. This is like a 2 a.m. podcast, so I don't know who said this, but it was like a feminist scholar. And she was saying how what's moved the women's movement forward the most in the 20th century was stories, you know? And I was thinking about that, how... when I grew up, I watched reruns of Leave It to Beaver before school. So, like, June Cleaver was, like the mother figure, right? Or the, like, womanhood to me, in a way. But then I think, like, the Mary Tyler Moore, Murphy Brown, Katniss Evergreen. You know what I mean? These stories not only reflected who we are culturally, but they defined, you know, new ways of being. So, yeah, there you go.
Perfect. All right. We're going to take questions from you guys. I hope you've all been preparing, getting ready to come up. Don't touch the mic.
Yeah. It'll,
All right, we got to take her.
It'll shock you. And Berkeley police are hiding up there in the rafters.
I guess I'll go first.
Yeah.
So I've participated in several... Thank you. Yeah. I like the shirt, too. Yeah. So I've participated in several writing challenges, not NaNoWriMo, but like 30,000-word challenges and what have you. Yeah. And that seems to be my limit. I can't push myself to write past that.
Yes, you can.
I keep trying. Any advice for pulling things together to continue to write past what?
So you're talking about like trying to reach 50,000 words in a month, or to keep going like year round?
Trying to either pushing myself beyond what I think I can do.
Yeah, you know, the thing I hear most frequently when people say they can't do National Novel Writing Month is that they don't have enough time. And so I always recommend, I do think like reaching 50,000 words is super challenging. And I mean, 30,000 words is huge and you should feel really great about that. So don't diminish yourself in any way. I think writing 10,000 words is really great. But I do think, like, to reach 50,000 words in a month or to keep writing year-round, you have to really think about your life and how you're spending your time. And that's what one reason that, like, a goal and a deadline are a creative midwife is that, for me, every year before I do NaNoWriMo, I go on what we call a time hunt. And I record how I spend a day in 15-minute increments. And there was even this fancy software out there where you can see how much time you spend on the internet, you know, or on your computer. And it's really helpful, though, because, like our, how we use our time, is it's all about choices, right? And what's a priority. But sometimes we don't, with those choices, we don't honor what's an actual priority, I guess. And so when I go on a time hunt, what I discover are all these pockets of time, like Toni Morrison's 15 minutes, where I could be using that time to write, even if it wasn't the glorious time of, like, having 3 or 4 hours in the morning every day. Because I don't, you know, like, I'm a working parent. Time is super scarce, so I have to be really, really disciplined, you know? And so, like, I have to, like, think, how am I going to reach 50,000 words a month? How am I going to open up 2 hours a day to write? Or more. So it might be writing at lunch, it might be writing 15 minutes before bedtime, it might be waking up early. That's the best advice I think I can offer. Yeah, yeah. And then take that beyond the month, though. Think about how you can show up and write regularly. Yeah.
Can I take that question a little further?
Yeah.
Because for me, it's not the time. It's like I hit 25,000.
You're the first person I've ever heard who said you have enough time.
I'm sorry single, to put you on the spot. No kids.
Yeah.
So
great, that's good.
Exactly.
It's solved.
But exactly, just single, no kids. Easy, no pets either. But I hit the 25,000 and then I get bored with my idea. I can't take the idea further. And so if you can address that, that'd be wonderful.
Well, so you get bored with it. This is like psychoanalysis now. I'm trying to, you know, that happens to everybody. I think every writer, I call it the muddy middle, or just this swampland of the middle of a novel. It's the toughest part. It's much easier to start and much easier to finish, but that middle is really, really problematic. I just read an interview with Andrew Sean Greer, who just won the Pulitzer for his novel Less, and he said, generally about 2/3 of the way through a novel, he has a nervous breakdown. You know, he sits on the couch and literally cannot move forward. He has so much self-doubt, or maybe boredom with the story, you know? I mean, it's very easy to get bored with your story when you work on it, perhaps for years even. He actually said he scheduled his nervous breakdown before this latest novel, so that's good to have. But, you know, I think the only thing I can say is that, you know, every writer experiences that. I mean, every time I start, you know, you'd think that after, like, writing a bunch of novels that you would somehow know how to navigate around that, but it's always sort of a surprise, and every writer is like, you know, there's this question, should I keep going? And it's kind of like when I was saying earlier that you really don't know how good a novel is or how meaningful it's going to be for you until you see it to the end, until you write it. So I do think it's like any kind of, like, it is like a sports training exercise, right? Like, I'm sure marathon runners wake up some days and they're just like, they do not want to do the running training, you know? And so, but as an author, you've got to get through those rough patches. And the only thing I can say is it is like relentlessness and doggedness and just telling yourself, like, the getting through this rough patch, you're going to find more meaning in the story. You're going to find moments that it excites you. I mean, the idea of writing, like it's not supposed to excite you every day. You know, you have to have those bad days where you're just doing the work. Somebody told me this great story just a few days ago about, because I don't believe in writer's block. I think there's always a technique or something you can do to get over the writer's block. And she told the story, somebody told her about his father was a truck driver. Every day for 30 or 40 years, he woke up and drove the truck. He didn't wake up and say, oh, I have truck driving block. I can't drive the truck anymore. You know, we have these strange notions about how we don't keep putting words on the page, so. He was probably bored driving the truck too, you know. Yeah. Also, you know, sometimes, I mean, the 100-word stories serve this purpose to me too, because I could leave my novel, go do this other exercise, feel this immense sense of satisfaction that I'd written something to completion, and then go back. You know, so there's no rule that you have to just write your novel only. So a lot of writers skip around.
Yeah, I just want to interject quickly, too. I know I'm not saying this is your thing, but a lot of times when I'm working with people who say that they're bored of their own work, I do think that there's an edge of inner critic stuff coming up, mm-hmm. you know, that it's actually not boring, but you're bored of your own work, and then there becomes a block there. And so that is, I have mixed feelings about writers groups, but sometimes mm-hmm. I think finding a critique partner or a writing coach at that point just to say, look, can I get some feedback on this? So that it's not this isolation, you know, where you have lost any sense of objectivity, you know, because it's not an objective process. And if you've been with it a long time, that might be something that could push you through.
Mm-hmm. Think about what you like about it, too. Yeah. Yeah.
So NaNoWriMo is all about, like, ramping up your speedometer, right? Can you talk about the process of going from maybe writing sometimes to being prolific?
Do NaNoWriMo. meaning the challenges of going from not writing a lot to, are you talking about like that journey of becoming prolific? I mean, I've encountered that writers are all different types and have all different, I think they are like athletes and they have different speeds that are sometimes kind of wired in your head. And so some people are more slow, methodical writers, and some people write more quickly. I actually did NaNoWriMo because I was a very slow, methodical writer, and I just wanted to experiment with a different creative process. So I really just recommend that people try different creative processes, just for the heck of it, just to shake things up. But really, like, work within what is good for you. You know, that's what it's really about in the end, is for you to discover your own creative process, your own speed, and then make it work. Because some people feel that they don't write as well when they write quickly, you know? I mean, I like to think there's this notion that writing slower produces better quality of writing, and that's not necessarily true. I like to tell this story between, it's in the Art of Healing, I think, book. This ceramics professor divided his class up into two groups. Half of the class got graded on, they had to do one pot and make it perfect. The other half of the class got graded on just the number of pots they made, the volume. And what he found is the people who made more pots made better pots because they were doing more and experimenting more and trying out new concepts. So, I do both. I still cling to my, like, slow, methodical approach when I'm not doing NaNoWriMo, but it's good sometimes just to, you know, sometimes I'll just be, like, stuck in the middle and say, well, let's get off the laptop and I'm going to just write crazy thoughts for 5 minutes as fast as I can. And that's why I don't believe in writer's block, is because I do these word sprints with people and I give them a simple prompt, and I've never had anyone not be able to write for 5 or 10 minutes. So, yeah. Yeah. Don't be afraid of coming up to the mic. Just don't touch it.
Hi. I have a question about first-time publishing.
Yeah.
So I have written 2 children's books that kind of flowed, and I'm onto a historical novel about Japan, because I lived there quite a while. But the publishing part, do you have any advice for?
I'm gonna let Brooke handle this one.
How you can find I handle?
Yeah, well, you should come to the Future of Publishing panel tonight. There is a publishing panel tonight. I am moderating it. I should know when it is. It's like at 5:45, so that would be the better place to talk about book
it's
publishing.
What?
Future of Book Publishing.
Okay, yeah. I think I signed up for that one.
4:45, yes, thank you. I yeah, come to that and that. We can talk all publishing all night.
Okay, that would be great.
Yeah. But maybe it would be interesting after this question. I mean, I'd love to hear a little bit, if there's time, about how your publishing experience has felt to you. So let's let.
Good, all right.
Yeah.
Nori.
Hello. Thank you so much. So for me, writing brings out the obsessive compulsiveness in me, and I'm sure it does in most writers. Mm-hmm. And I find that I'm always thinking about my book 24/7. If I wake up in the night, I'm thinking.
That's
while
great.
I'm swimming, I'm thinking. And I can't, and it kind of consumes you. So I'm wondering, when you're really in the zone, as I call it, do you ever take a vacation? Do you ever stop? Do you ever, when you do a vacation with your family, are you off duty? You know, as a writer, how do you stop when you need to? Because it's kind of healthy to live a balanced life, but I'm just consumed with writing my book right now, and I want to make sure that I don't burn out. So if you could just comment on that.
Yeah, I'm actually very envious of you. I feel like my life is just so full of interruptions and so fragmented that I can rarely get in the zone like you are. So I think it sounds like you must have just an amazingly powerful idea that you need to do whatever it takes to get it written. I think sometimes my wife and I joke, we wonder how our kids are going to remember their childhood because they had two writing parents who were basically looking for that scarce resource of time, you know. So a lot of our family life has been essentially my wife and I either going out to the office or writing, you know, in, you know, the living room with them. So I don't know. It's tough to strike the balance, but I don't know how to answer the question really, except the maybe to. It sounds like it is overwhelming you maybe a little bit, and so to can you shut it off? Like it just always comes back.
Are you worried about burning out? You are. Okay.
Because I haven't finished things in the past because.
Gotcha.
Yeah, treat it as a job. Finish it. Get it done. No, seriously. Like, write it and get it out of you. I mean, that's kind of the thing. And then, yeah. But I wouldn't worry about it too much. I'm sure everyone around you is going to be fine. yeah.
I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what it feels like when you write.
Uh-huh.
Does it make you happy? What is that sense when you actually do get the time?
That's a really great question. There's a famous quote by, why am I spacing on her name? It's a famous quote. Really sharp-witted writer in the 20s. Anyway, she said, I hate writing. I love having written. I think that's what she said. Dorothy Parker. And I think a lot of writers feel this because it can feel very anguishing to open up and write. It can be whatever, uncomfortable. It's amazing we do it, right? It's like it can be very painful in some ways. At the same time, like afterwards, it's so deeply meaningful to know that I've spent like 2 hours writing that morning. Like when I don't write, I am more cranky the rest of the day, you know. So I think of writing, I feel like it's like a prayer in a way. It's my, like, I'm not religious, I don't practice religion, but it's my religion, you know. And so words are the way that I find meaning in the world. So even if it's anguishing or painful, it's meaningful somehow. It's a funny thing because I think there are people out there who just are happy doing it. They, you know, they're just typing away. I don't know.
Fran's very gloomy, though. So.
Yeah, I'm very gloomy. I've got the gloomy music on. I'm melancholic. Yeah.
Hi. I think I basically want to say thank you for your talk. It's been very refreshing as someone who is in a position where I'm trying to soak up advice and inspiration. I find a lot of the articles of like the 5 things you need to do to be a writer or the 6 things you need to do to be the most creative person, and you realize that you'd have to wake up at 4 in the morning and write consistently in a dark room and then go for a 3-hour walk and drink lemon water, and somewhere in there you have a day job and people in your life. So I'd love to, I guess, hear your thoughts on just your position, seeing all these different people writing in so many different ways and kind of navigating the logistics of organizing your day with being reasonable and having a day job and all of that.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. I actually wasn't joking. I do get up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning to write, just because it's the only time that's quiet and I wake up naturally and my kids are still asleep, stuff like that. I don't know. I think it just gets back to that principle of I do feel like it's amazing what, I mean, when I was joking earlier that there are 5 to 7 writing books when I decided to be a writer, that was true. And now it is like, you know, whatever. There are thousands of writing books and all this advice. But again, I think it's like a journey where you have to figure out what works for you. You know, every writer is different. And whether you're writing 15 minutes a day like Toni Morrison to get it done, or if you're waking up early, or if you're doing NaNoWriMo, you know, just think about how it fits into your life. And I guess the one powerful thing about NaNoWriMo is we say everyone has a story to tell and everyone's story matters. And it's important that everyone write their story their way. And so I would try not to get caught up in other prescriptions, you know, unless they're meaningful to you, you know. But I think one good thing about reading all those articles, I mean, I feel like reading those articles is a way of engaging in a creative community, you know. Like I wasn't part of a face-to-face community in a lot of my life, but it was a type of community for me to read author interviews or to come to things like this. And I don't know. Am I answering your question? I'm not sure if I know how to.
Well, it's a very vague question, too. But no, I just appreciate your thoughts on it. Because I look forward to reading your book and not getting the very prescriptive, like, you must do these things.
There's no musts, really. Do you feel like, are you writing in your life, have you structured it so that you're having a meaningful writing experience, that you're doing it regularly, that you're doing what you want to do?
Yes. And then and this is maybe just personal for me, then you read this like, oh, but I could be doing more, or I could be doing it this way. Well, and you know what,
as a writer, that never goes away, really. I mean, I never have enough time to write. You never really have a breather, even when you like finish a novel. There's always more to do, but that's the beauty of it too, you know. So, yeah.
What's fun about this book too is everybody should buy it. I can see they're putting out the tables on the back. What I love about it is like you literally can just dip into any one of them on any given day. And I was reading it while I was on the plane, but I didn't finish. You know, I almost felt like I wouldn't want to. You know, that I didn't want to take on so much in just one sitting. And so it's like it has that kind of daily, except that it's weekly, you know, where you just kind of take what you need when you need it and they can be reread.
It's kind of designed for that. There's a little topic index at the back, which, you know, if you're having whatever trouble with your muse, you know, there's a chapter on that. You can just look at different, like starting a new project.
Yeah,
things like
that's
that.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Shannon, NaNoWriMo's superhero is approaching the mic.
Well, I did want to promote it, of course, but one of the things you talked earlier about was the constraint that the program has, and I wanted to ask you some different inspirational, you know, things you've heard from participants, because I know NaNoWriMo allowed me to actually finish my first book. I don't know if a lot of you know, but or have dealt with this, but you're writing and rewriting, you're writing, you never write the end, and so NaNoWriMo, because there was this deadline, I was able to, like, I have to finish it by the 30th. So it forced me to finally finish a story.
Yeah.
So can you share any
That's
more?
Awesome.
I do feel like, and per 25,000 words there, I feel like there's a special joy in finishing and getting to the end. And so I think that everyone should experience that. You mentioned different techniques. So one I heard recently that I really like, so we do, as I mentioned, these word sprints that might be 5 or 10 minutes with a prompt, and it's all about just getting words on the page. A writer told me the way she likes to do it, and so that's kind of like the Pomodoro method. I don't know if people have heard that, but she does a different version of it. She writes, it's called the unit method. I don't know why all these things need words, but labels, but she writes for 45 minutes, and then she takes a 15-minute break. So that break could be like taking a walk, reading the newspaper, washing the dishes, and then she comes back and writes for another 45 minutes. And the reason I think this is really great is, one, she says that, and this will help you with the middles too, she says that if she's stuck after 20 minutes, she knows she only has to write for 25 more minutes. It's not this open-ended sort of challenge. And so she has that deadline again. It's a constraint. And then that 15 minutes, everything that she wrote, it's like percolating there. It's like refueling. And then she can come back for another session. And I think that's like a really great way to write. And we've had NaNoWriMo participants actually structure their writing around their work lives. Like this one woman like laid out a grid for the whole day. Like she would write for half an hour, then clean the oven, write for half an hour, then, which I actually thought is a great way, because it's rare that you have a clean house and a novel. Yeah.
Yeah. That's perfect.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one benefit is that when you realize, it's like running a marathon or climbing a mountain, when you realize you can do something big, like write a novel, it changes a lot of people's whole experience of life, because they know they can do something big, and they do big things in other ways.
Awesome. Well, we're ending in 3 minutes, but I think we're actually going to end just to get people shuffled to the back so that Grant can get to the table and you guys can buy some books and talk to him in the back of the room. And thank you all so much for being here. And thank you, Grant, for
Brooke. That was great. And thanks, everybody. I love talking writing. So if you want to hang, I'll be here for a while. No deadlines. I'd love to hang out. I am going to go to the restroom first, though.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.